For almost a century, in the month of January, a growing number of Christians from denominations across the board have set aside a week of prayer for Christian unity, an initiative that began with a group of Episcopalian Catholic religious in the United States. They chose January 18th to the 25th, the week in which we celebrate feast days of the saints Peter and Paul, the apostles revered by all Christians.
From its very earliest days, the Church in Rome remembers the 18th of January as the feast of the Cathedra Petri, the feast of the chair of Peter, the day on which the Apostle Peter first led a service with the faithful in Rome. It's also the day set aside to recall Peter's confession of belief. January the 25th celebrates the feast of the conversion of St. Paul. The two feasts mark the great moments of truth for the two apostles in fully accepting God's will. At Caesarea Philippi, when Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" St. Peter replied, "You are the Messiah." And on the road to Damascus, St. Paul was blinded when Christ appeared to him and forever changed his life into one of spreading the good news.
The week of prayer for Christian unity was the brainchild of Episcopalian Reverend Lewis Watson, who, together with Sister Lorana White, in the early 1900s formed a new religious community within the Episcopalian Church in New York, following the Franciscan rule of life. Watson chose as his new religious name Father Paul James Francis. Well, after years of intense ecumenical work advocating the reunification of Christian churches, Father Paul and Mother Lorana decided to enter the Catholic Church. In 1909, their Society of the Atonement was received into the Roman Catholic Church, the first religious community to do so since the 16th century Reformation. Each year, the theme and the text for the Week of Prayer are chosen and prepared by representatives of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity and representatives of the World Council of Churches. Catherine Smybert talked to one member of the Society of the Atonement who tells us more about how this important annual ecumenical event came about.
It began as an outreach among Anglo-Catholics because the Society of the Atonement was founded in the Episcopal Church, USA, as a Franciscan community at Graymore in Garrison, New York.
Father James Loughran is the director of the Society of the Atonement's New York-based Graymore Ecumenical and Interreligious Institute. He attempted to sum up the history of how the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity has developed since its conception by the co-founder of his order in 1908.
In the end of the 19th century, in 1898, as a movement of men and women, really, in the Anglican Church who sought unity with the Roman Catholic Church, very simply, they believed that there was some process by which Anglicans and Roman Catholics could come together to reunite into one community. It was very naive in a way, but also very faith-filled. They believed that this would be a work of the Holy Spirit, and Father Paul Watson, the founder of the Friars of the Atonement, would often go to various Episcopal churches to preach this idea of reunion, as he called it, with Rome. And his message was not very well received. And so he began to develop a magazine called The Lamp Magazine, first published in 1903, while still an Anglican. And he used that as a vehicle to promote what he called at that time Christian unity or reunionism. In the process, he befriended an Anglican priest named Spencer Jones in England, who was also in the Anglo-Catholic movement and wanted to set aside a day a year to pray for the unity of the church. And so Father Paul Watson responded, "Wouldn't it be better to use the traditional octave, 8 days of prayer?" And so he thought perhaps January 18th to 25th would be good, because on our older calendar, January 18th was the Feast of the Chair of Peter, and the 25th is still the Feast of the Conversion of Paul. And so Spencer Jones agreed, and Father Paul, through his Lamp magazine, began to promote the idea around 1907, and in 1908 they actually celebrated in January the first Church Unity Octave, as it was called then, at Graymore.
The continuation and growth of this idea was fueled a year later by the unique ecumenical leap of faith taken by this entire community. It was then picked up by Europe and expanded upon during one of the most famous Vatican events of history.
It was in October of 1909, after the second week of prayer for Christian unity, which was, I should say, called the Church Unity Octave, that Father Paul and the foundress, Mother Lorena, and the other friars and sisters of the Atonement became Roman Catholics. They were corporately welcomed into the Catholic Church by Pope Pius X and put under the care of the Archdiocese of New York at the time. Over the years, as the friars grew in the Catholic Church, the commitment to pray for the unity of the Church continued. However, since this was before the Second Vatican Council, the Church Unity Octave focused on praying for the return of other Christians to the fullness of communion with the Catholic Church. And so it became, in a sense, a prayer by Catholics for the other Christians to come into full communion with the Catholic Church. After the Second Vatican Council, things began to change, of course, with Lumen Gentium and then, of course, the Decree on Ecumenism, so that we could begin to pray together with other Christians, that the unity of the Church would come about as Christ wills it, which, of course, was the founding principle of Christian unity prayer in Europe at the time as well. So by Father Paul Couturier and others who started that movement in the 1920s to pray for the unity of the Church ecumenically rather than in a sort of one-directional type of thing.
Now, the Society of the Atonement works on many levels around the world. Coupled by their commitment or charism to prayer for the unity of the Church for the sake of the mission of it, as well as being known and esteemed for their work at the Graymore Institute, they're recognized in Asia, throughout Europe, and in Rome at their Centro Pro Unione. Sister Lorelei Fuchs is almost the personification of Church activity towards unity, and she is the first to point out that though the situation of dialogue certainly varies from country to culture, it's something that affects us all, not just in places like Russia or Iraq, but in fact, as Sister Fuchs told me, with the melting pot of Western society around us, it's an element of life that none of us can ignore.
Again, I think if we look at the United States, we're in a very unique situation here because we live very ecumenically, unlike, say, many countries in Europe, like Italy, for example, we're rubbing shoulders with other Protestants, other Christians, Protestants, Orthodox, as well as the whole interreligious Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Sikhs. Everybody's on the subway with you when you come to work here. In terms of dialogue, though, Catherine, I think one of the things that's an asset for us here is that we try in the United States, the churches, to have dialogues at all levels. So, of course, there is the highest level of international dialogues, which, again, the Roman Catholic Church has been in the forefront of bilateral relations of that nature. There's also national dialogues, each country having a dialogue, and the United States is in the forefront of that as well. But then there's also local dialogue. So, for example, regionally in the New York area, which then goes to either the synod or the dioceses of the different churches, I'm personally involved in the local ARC dialogue, Anglican Roman Catholic. There's a local Lutheran Roman Catholic dialogue, and then I'm also Cardinal Egan's appointee for the Lutheran Episcopal Dialogue as a partner sitting in on that dialogue locally. And I think it's the local that sometimes becomes more important in some ways than the national or the international, because that's where the grassroots understanding and reception of the message for the unity of the Church and the unity of Christians comes about. So it's an advantage by the fact that it's happening on various levels and various fronts. And it's a privilege. I'm on one international dialogue. I'm on the Methodist Roman Catholic dialogue, which Cardinal Casper assigned me 4 years ago. We finish up a text next year in Vienna to finish a five-year phase. I just came back, in fact, from Krakow, Poland, where the Methodist Roman Catholic Commission met recently.
Sister Fuchs speaks of getting the ecumenical message to the people in the pews. So I asked her what actions she would recommend the faithful do or take to make a convincing step toward unity in their own communities.
I think a tremendous effort that could be made, or a step that could be made, is that, and some dioceses in this country have done this, synods and other groups, that at certain levels, including the local congregational level, have a point person, have somebody responsible to lift up what is happening ecumenically, and to kind of do the ecumenical possible, not the ecumenical impossible. I think sometimes we set up goals too hard to reach. So, for example, something very practical. In a Catholic parish, have a PER, a parish ecumenical representative, who at the parish council will inform and be informed about things happening in the churches. Like if there is a dialogue text that's issued, like recently a Lutheran Roman Catholic dialogue at the national level in the United States was issued. So to find out what's happening, or to even, for example, lift up who are the other churches besides the Roman Catholic Church in your area, to know who is the Methodist around the corner or the Presbyterian down the road, and what collaborative efforts could be done as Christians together, for example, sharing a soup kitchen or a crop walk or things like that. I think also, just like on a parish council, there'd be somebody who's concerned about the worship of the parish. What about at the worship on Sunday mornings at Mass, including the intercessions, a church in the locale, and pray for that church as well? Another possibility, which I think has tremendous potential that we haven't tapped, is there is a lot of convergence and consensus on a common baptism, a baptism in a water rite with a Trinitarian formula, which most people who call themselves Christians and most churches who call themselves Christians does. And why not attempt baptismal preparation classes for sponsors and parents together? So I think there's little steps that could be made. Also in some dioceses here, there's been an effort over the last 10 years to have a common baptismal certificate, that the churches give out a common piece of paper, a paper that looks the same. And that also would have kind of an effect when later on it's handed in for another rite or another sacrament. And, you know, the Presbyterian minister sees the same document, but, oh, it's, you know, Curia Vars, Roman Catholic Church, is the one who baptized this Christian. So I think there's a lot of little steps we can do that we kind of lose sight of.
I'm Catherine Smybert.